Welcome to All Sides with Dan Fisher. We're talking about the state budget again today. And because we're talking about state funds, whether they're when they're spent in any way on abortions, the conversation about them can be within the purview of the Ohio General Assembly as it considers the state budget. This week, Senate Republican leadership took advantage of that purview and inserted two abortion-related provisions into the bill just hours before approving it. One of the provisions would ban abortions in any facility that receives state money, and the other would ban insurance plans for state and local government employees, ban them from covering abortions. That ban would not apply to local governments under home rule, which includes Columbus and Cleveland, for example. Joining us via telephone from Cleveland today to talk about the issue is Kelly Copeland. She's executive director of NARAL Pro-Choice Ohio. She's also a board member of NARAL Pro-Choice America. Welcome to the show, Kelly.
Well, thank you so much. I'm glad to be here.
Welcome also to Stephanie Kreider. Stephanie is a lobbyist for the Ohio Right to Life. And welcome to the show, Stephanie.
Thank you, and I'm glad to be here this morning.
Stephanie, let's start with you. Is this something you've been working on with this legislature since they started at the beginning of the year?
Yes, absolutely. This is something that we have been working on since at least January of this year. It was something we identified as one of our legislative priorities coming into the year. So last fall, we decided this was something we thought we could get done coming up this year, this General Assembly, and we've been working with members since then.
One of the issues isn't even the bans or not. It's the how this was done. And if you've been working on the beginning of the year, since the beginning of the year, was one of the strategies to keep it under wraps and introduce it this way, like it was just a few hours before the Senate voted on it without debate?
I definitely think that, yes, strategically, I think it made sense for us to sort of hang on to it in our back pocket. Obviously, you know, we've got other bills, other irons in the fire, I guess you could say, that we've certainly been spending an awful lot of time on. And so this was something else that was sort of on our wish list that, you know, they seem fitting for the budget process, considering it has to do with taxpayer money. And we had been trying to get them included in the House. So it's, you know, I don't know that we planned to get them in at the very last minute in the Senate, but certainly we're not upset that they're included.
Kelly Copeland, how do you monitor these kinds of things? And was it really a surprise when the amendment was offered up and approved and became part of the bill?
We obviously monitor each version of the budget, and frankly, we had been hearing since January to expect some sort of abortion restrictions in the budget. However, we were more than disappointed that it happened at a point where there was not even an opportunity for public input. No medical experts were able to come testify about the dangers that these restrictions pose to women's health, and even Senate President Niehaus, I mean, they turned off their phones. So, you know, our activists who wanted to call and say, you know, they have grave concerns about these measures were, you know, left to voicemail and email. You know, when you're passing legislation that deals with women's health, I think that more of a hearing is appropriate. I really object to not only the substance of these amendments, but also the way this has been handled.
That's Kelly Copeland. She's executive director of NARAL Pro-Choice Ohio. Also with us is Stephanie Kreider. She's director of legislative affairs for the Ohio Right to Life. If you have a question or comment for them, we're talking about two provisions that have been inserted into the state budget that would further restrict access to abortions in the state of Ohio. Question or comment, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. We welcome your calls and your emails. This is a contentious issue. Can you tell our screener right off the bat if you're for or against the way the legislation is going? The executive director of the Ohio Right to Life, according to the Columbus Dispatch, rejected criticism from abortion rights activists about the lack of input, saying, quote, their quote, tired talking points aren't doing anything to protect women and the unborn. Does Ohio Right to Life believe that just because one side is weary of another's point of view that it doesn't deserve to be heard? I mean, if the tables were turned, Stephanie, what would your reaction be to a statement like that about your arguments against abortion rights?
Well, I think, you know, certainly as an organization, we have no opposition to everyone having their voice heard, having a chance to be heard. You know, if I can, I'd like to respond to something Kelly said, too. She mentioned it being a greater risk to women's health by including these amendments. And we would disagree with that. I think that, you know, just because we're banning performance of this is non-therapeutic abortions we're talking about as well. That basically means elective abortions.
Okay, you know what? I want to get into all of that. Mm-hmm. We have time to get into that. But I wanted to deal with the process first and have you respond to that. I promise we'll get to the substance of the legislation. But again, if the tables were turned and NARAL Pro-Choice Ohio said, we're tired of their arguments, who cares what they have to say, let's just move forward, it doesn't matter, what would your reaction be?
I'm certain our reaction would be similar to what Kelly's is, and I'm certain also that we have been in that position in the past. I couldn't cite a specific example, but that's sort of the nature of the legislature and how these things go, particularly in the budget process, it seems. Historically, you know, things are included at the last minute, things that don't seem, you know, they recently included something having to do with the level of alcohol allowed in beer, and that, you know, no one saw that coming. So this isn't uncommon, I wouldn't say either. I think that we probably would be in the same position Kelly is in, but then, you know, that's what lobbyists are for. That's what I've got my job for.
Kelly, it's all's fair in love and war and politics?
No. You know, we've never pulled a stunt like this where we've snuck something major into a budget legislation or anywhere else. We've always been proud of our policy initiatives like Prevention First to increase access to sex ed and contraceptives. You know, we don't need to hide behind procedural shenanigans because, you know, frankly, we think that that's not the way to go. We these are serious issues that impact people's lives in a profound way, and they deserve public debate and public input.
614-292-8513 or email us at allsides@wosu.org. If you want to, if you have a question or comment for our guests, and Tracy in Westerville, you oppose the language that was added to the state budget regarding abortion rights, and welcome to the show.
Thank you, Ann. I absolutely oppose it. I don't understand if people perceive or believe that they are so pro-life, why do you have to sneak and do this? Why did you have to sneak something in? And I'd love to know, I'd love someone on the anti-choice side to explain to me why, when you are talking about pro-life issues, you are only addressing women. You are only dealing with issues that relate to women's health. I have yet to see anyone on the anti-choice side sponsor a bill that talks about paternity issues, that talks about toughening laws for child support enforcement, that talks about vasectomies for men who have multiple children. Everything is always related to restricting women's access and women's health. Right to life means cradle to grave. So if you are pro-life, that means you are anti-death penalty. That means you are anti-war. But none of these legislators and none of the lobbyists who work for them are in any way, shape, or form putting anything that is remotely balanced. And
okay. Well, sorry, Tracy. Didn't mean to cut you off, but I wanted to give Stephanie Kreider a chance to respond. That was a little abrupt, but Stephanie?
Yeah, absolutely. I think that, you know, I want to be clear that, first of all, I'm a woman. I support women's rights. I support women's health. I don't believe that abortion is something that necessarily should be considered women's health. I think that we believe that we are protecting women from the horrors of what abortion is and what we know it to be. You know, particularly in regard to these specific amendments, this, again, is elective abortion that we're talking about. This isn't abortion that is to save the life of the mother or even in cases of rape or incest. So these are not the extreme amendments that I believe people are painting these to be. Additionally, you know, I take exception with people who say that, you know, if you're pro-life, it's got to be from cradle to grave. I think that, I mean, I agree. I think that's true. But if you are then anti-war and you are anti-death penalty, then by that same argument, you ought to be pro-life. And so I think that that goes both ways.
Kelly Copeland from NARAL Pro-Choice Ohio.
Well, you know, obviously you can hear the passion in Tracy's voice. And, you know, there are lots of women who have serious concerns about what's in these bills. And to the point that these are for elective abortions, that is not entirely true. Neither of these provisions include an exception for a woman's health or for mental health. So what that does, it's going to force doctors to wait until their patients are sick enough that their life is endangered before they can terminate a pregnancy for a health reason. It also means that they cannot terminate a pregnancy for severe fetal anomalies, when there's been fetal demise and other things, until the situation jeopardizes the woman's life. I wish healthcare decisions were really simple, but the fact is things change very quickly. Pregnancies can turn on a dime, and women should have the peace of mind to know that the best hospitals in the state and that their insurance coverage will cover this legal procedure when they need it.
Just once again to Tracy, we're sorry about that. It was completely unintentional. Thanks for your call. We want to hear from folks who are for the legislation. We have people waiting to talk against it. We welcome the calls for it, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. If you like Facebook, you can go there to the All Sides with Ann Fisher Facebook page as well. No one can say what the impact will be exactly in terms of state expenditures. Senate President Tom Niehaus said he couldn't name one hospital that performs quote unquote elective abortions. So what's the point, Stephanie Kreider?
The purpose of this, you know, it isn't that we're necessarily trying to put an end to, you know, high numbers of abortion, although that is certainly something we're always trying to do. But the purpose of this is that we are just protecting taxpayer funding of abortion. We are preventing that in the future. And so any instance where that might happen in a hospital, we want to protect our tax dollars. We know that the more public funds are allocated, I guess, for abortion, the more public funds are available for abortion, the more abortion you get.
When you're in the hospital, sometimes healthcare decisions are made, you know, they're hard to categorize, particularly when there's, you don't know, I mean, necessarily. They may be precautionary. And in the hospital, there are no elective abortions per se. No one goes into a hospital to get an abortion, but they may, there may be medical decisions made in the process. Who is going to decide what was appropriate in that particular case, and how will you enforce it given health privacy laws?
Well, I believe that, you know, physicians will still have the discretion to decide when an abortion is necessary and when it is not. There are, you know, other processes, other avenues available to women if they are in a situation like something Kelly is describing, where it's not necessarily life-threatening, but they decide that an abortion is still in the woman's best interest. If a woman makes that decision, she could still go to, you know, her doctor's office or to a clinic nearby. So this isn't a total a total restriction for that woman. She's still got options available to her.
Kelly, do you have a sense about what enforcement would be like in these kind of situations?
Well, I don't. And, you know, the thing is, what I can tell you is it's going to have a chilling impact on physicians and hospitals who are going to be worried that the government is looking over their shoulder on every medical decision. And to address the point that Stephanie made that, this somehow is protecting taxpayer funding, that's nonsense. We already have laws in Ohio that prohibit state funds from being used to pay for abortions that are not necessary to protect a woman's life or in cases of reported rape or incest. These are abortions paid for by private funds at public facilities, some of the best facilities in the state. And you can't just simply sometimes go to a standalone abortion clinic for a procedure because you may have a heart condition, you may have diabetes or other things that really require for your best health to be in a hospital setting when that pregnancy is terminated, and to force women to be turned away from our best and brightest physicians and hospitals over, you know, basically the paper dragon. I mean, there is no taxpayer funding for abortion at these facilities. These are paid with private dollars.
Okay. We're going to continue the conversation about the legislation that's been inserted into the state budgets, moving just approved by the Senate. Probably goes to a conference committee right now, if my memory serves me. And then the governor signs it. If you have a question or comment, 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. Let our caller know. Let our screener know if you are for or against the legislation that further limits access to abortions in the state of Ohio. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
This is 89.7 NPR News. Join us this afternoon at 1 o'clock for On Point. State and national parks are in trouble. On Point looks at what's ahead for camping, canoeing, and the great outdoors. That discussion this afternoon at 1 on Point on 89.7 NPR News.
Support for 89.7 comes from the Sherrington Group, financial planners and investment managers providing financial advice and client-focused solutions to help grow and preserve clients' wealth. The Sherrington Group, planning for success, managing for life at sherringtongroup.com.
81 degrees in downtown Columbus. There is a chance of pop-up showers and thunderstorms mainly afternoon today, otherwise partly sunny and a high near 90. There's a chance of showers and thunderstorms tonight as well, a low of 66. And that chance of rain sticks around for Friday, partly sunny skies, a high of 85. All Sides with Ann Fisher continues. This is 89.7 NPR News. Thanks for joining us.
We are talking about two provisions that were amended into the state budget legislation in the Ohio Senate. It's already passed the House. It went to the Senate. This is one of the many changes the Senate made, and now it goes to a conference committee where they'll reconcile their differences, and after that it goes to the governor. This language was inserted without debate in the Senate, and that's part of what opponents of the restrictions are struggling with, but I just want to remind folks what it is they do. One of the provisions would ban abortions in any facility that receives state money. So regardless of how you're paying for it personally, if that hospital or a facility is in any way state-funded, you wouldn't be able to have the abortion there. And the other would ban insurance plans that cover state and local government employees from paying for abortions. And that ban would not apply to local governments under home rule, and that includes Columbus and Cleveland and some other places. If you have a question or comment, 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. And Kate in Westerville, you support the changes to the state budget. Welcome to the show.
Hi. Yes, I do. And here's my pro-life morally, but even if I were not, if I were a person who was kind of indifferent to the whole question, why should my money go to this when the budget is short of money everywhere? The schools are short of money. We just heard that the parks are short of money. Why is this one of the things I should be forced to pay for?
How do you, and thank you for that call, Kate. Stephanie Kreider, how do you break out what exactly the savings will be to the state? What does an abortion cost? I mean, how do you figure that as a savings to the state?
Well, my understanding is there's a wide range of the cost for abortion depending on when the procedure is performed, at what point in pregnancy, and any other complications. So honestly, Kelly might be able to speak a little bit better to that than I can. But, you know, I don't know that we came into this looking at this being a cost savings for the state so much as this is about protecting the rights of pro-life taxpayers who don't want their dollars going to abortion to pay for someone else's abortion.
Kelly Copeland from NARAL.
Well, the fact of the matter is that this doesn't stop any state dollars from going to pay for an abortion because they don't now. As we've already kind of talked about what happens in these hospitals and medical facilities. Mm-hmm. But in terms of the insurance plans, there's already legislation that bans abortion coverage in state employee health plans. What this does is say we're going to tell all the townships what type of insurance to offer their employees. And, you know, the bottom line is that all women should have access to safe medical care, no matter where they work. An overwhelming majority of private insurance plans cover abortion. And these politicians, they should not be able to take away that coverage from women just based on where they work.
Kelly, is there, I read that you said there may be a constitutional issue here. What would that be?
Well, it could be that they're overreaching in terms of the negotiations for bargaining for insurance plans for the local hospitals. It could also be an overreach with the hospitals because they're banning procedures that the state doesn't pay for. And there may be federal dollars that are tied into some of these hospitals as well. So, you know, this is pretty murky bureaucratic stuff here. And, you know, we, you know, only got our hands on the language very late, and our lawyers are still parsing through this. I mean, even Speaker Batchelder seemed kind of dubious about these restrictions and whether or not they were legally appropriate.
How so?
Well, he mentioned concerns about federal funds with hospitals and what other regulations might apply.
Thanks to Kate for that call. Nancy in Columbus, you're on the air. Welcome to the show. You oppose the legislation.
Thank you. I do oppose this legislation. It's clear to me that it's an attack on the women of Ohio. And I'm curious to know why people continue to say that this would save taxpayer dollars, that this has nothing to do with taxpayer dollars. This actually prevents hospitals from saving women's lives. I wish your guests could address that.
Stephanie Kreider from Ohio Right to Life.
Again, it's not about saving taxpayer dollars necessarily from the state. It's about keeping taxpayer dollars from funding abortions. And so, you know, even in the case of public hospitals, public money is going to fund those hospitals, whether it's the facilities, the equipment, the salaries of those who are considered public employees. All of those things are taxpayer funded. And so it's not about having a net effect of saving them money. It's about saving the taxpayer dollars from going to abortion.
Let me ask you this. If someone goes to a hospital and they have an abortion and it's deemed not to fall within the categories allowed in this legislation, but they're paying for it. You mean they're not really paying for it? They are paying for it with their own money or with their own insurance coverage. You're saying because a fraction of, you know, that ancillary funding that comes from the government.
Yeah, absolutely. There's still costs there that the government is incurring, whether, again, it's the facilities, whether it's keeping the lights on, whether it's paying that physician.
Okay. Thank you, Nancy, for that call. If you want to give us a call, make sure you tell our screener if you're for or against. The number is 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. We have an email from Charlotte. She says, I don't give a tinker's damn what some super antiquated clerics in Rome or their political lackeys in Columbus presume to think they know about my life, my morals, or my decision to complete or to abort a pregnancy. The only cleric I pay attention to when it comes to my reproductive life is that pesky Augustinian Gregor Johann Mengel and his seminal work with pea plants. Knowing that bipolar disorder runs rampant on my father's side of the family, I chose to abstain from motherhood for damn good reasons. Knowing that Roe versus Wade was there to protect me in case I slipped up gave me the sense of security I needed. Stephanie Kreider, you know, there are exceptions in the legislation in cases of rape and incest. What's the difference between that ill conception and somebody who may have, you know, maybe their birth control doesn't work and they have serious reservations about giving birth to a child that they're seriously concerned could carry on be a genetic carrier or something.
Mm-hmm. Thanks for that question, Ann. Actually, you know, I should speak to this too. The rape and incest exception in here is in here to comply with the very concerns that I believe Speaker Batchelder brought up and what Kelly was just discussing about the legality of these amendments.
The federal.
Exactly, yeah, about losing any federal funding. This complies with federal standards because it includes the rape and incest exception and the exception for the life of the mother. Ohio Right to Life is not in favor of making an exception in any abortion restriction for rape and incest, just because we do believe that regardless of how a child is conceived, it still has a right to life. And so that is consistent with our view of, you know, anything having to do with fetal anomalies or, you know, you're talking about a baby being a carrier of a disease or something like that. Mm-hmm. We think that, you know, regardless of someone's disability, they should still have a right to life. So if you met a person with bipolar, you would never say to them, it would be better if you weren't born. You would never say that to someone. And so to say that, you know, before they even have a chance to live is completely unfair.
Kelly Copeland?
Well, yes. I think that this boils down to who decides. Should women and their doctors be making these very personal, private decisions? Or should Ohio Right to Life or Senate President Niehaus or Speaker Batchelder? We believe that fundamentally this decision rests with the woman, that she should be able to make the best decisions for her and her family, and that, you know, politicians who campaigned on less government should not now turn around and want to make this extreme government interference in a woman's personal decision. And to kind of go back to this notion that Stephanie said earlier, that, you know, because a state dollar might go to pay for a light bulb at a hospital, that's public funding for abortion. That's absurd. I mean, we might as well say that we should close all the abortion clinics because the state pays somebody to regulate them, or because, you know, the police are, you know, forced to patrol their neighborhoods. I mean, this is going to an absurd level of interference into women's personal private medical decisions.
So Kelly Copeland from NARAL is describing something of a slippery slope, perhaps. Stephanie Kreider, is that something you would welcome, that slippery slope?
Or
do you think that borders on the ridiculous too?
No, I think, you know, I kind of smiled to myself when Kelly was just talking, because honestly, we would love to close every abortion clinic in the state. That's a goal of Ohio Right to Life. We want to end abortion in the state. I think that in general, everyone can agree that we want to see less abortions. And so if this is just another avenue to pursue that, then that's the way that we're going to go.
614-292-8513 if you want to give us a call. Kelly Copeland, this affects so few people, really. Why does it matter so much to NARAL Pro-Choice Ohio?
Because we have worked with women who have had abortions that were necessary for their health, that they would have gone and done illegal things. They would have tried to self-abort and perhaps jeopardize their lives. It's not the number of women it impacts. It's the impact on a woman. And if just one woman is harmed by this, then shame on us. And, you know, back to Stephanie's point, she said it herself. None of these regulations are really about taxpayer funding or about safety or about any of the other issues. It's about making abortion so inaccessible that it doesn't matter if it's legal or not. And your viewer or your listeners, they heard it from her, not from me.
Stephanie Kreider, what are you concerned at all? Is Ohio Right to Life concerned at all that that chilling effect that it could have on physicians, and they may decide against something? They'd make a decision based on this, and it could cost somebody their life?
No, I don't think so. I think that, you know, considering the advances we have in medical technology, even the AMA, the American Medical Association, will state that there are very few instances in which a woman, to save the woman's life, her child needs to be aborted. Typically, you know, a woman can go through her entire pregnancy and receive treatment for whatever else is going on. And, you know, I say that knowing women. I have friends who have gone through cancer treatments throughout their entire pregnancy and still delivered a healthy baby and still had a healthy outcome for themselves. So I don't believe that this is in any way tying a physician's hands.
Okay. Amy and Hilliard, you're on the air. You support the legislation. Welcome to the show.
Hi. I had a question. I just wanted to know how many pregnancies really truly need to be ended for the women's health, in contrast to how many are aborted electively? And then contrastly, I just wanted to know why there seems to be so much less support for adoption in that case, like that woman's email about delivering a baby that had that could be bipolar. I can think of, you know, 10 of my closest friends that would give anything to have a baby like that. And I just wanted to know just why there seems to be such a conflict with abortion, but then why there seems to be such little support for adoption. Thank you.
You're welcome. Thank you for the call. Kelly Copeland from NARAL Pro-Choice Ohio, you want to respond to that?
Absolutely. I'm glad to. It's a great question. We absolutely support adoption and all the options available to women. We helped pass a regulation in Ohio that increased the tax credit for adoptions, and we were proud to do that. We were proud to play a role in that. We support the full range of options, and we support women making those decisions, and for whatever reason that she feels that she needs to do so.
Stephanie Kreider from Ohio Right to Life, to what extent does Ohio Right to Life invest time and energy in issues like adoption, making adoption easier, in other women's health issues that would, and other issues, I think like one of the earlier callers brought up, making life easier for women so that they could make more easily have children?
We spend a significant amount of time supporting those efforts. I'd be remiss if I didn't mention, well, for one thing, we do absolutely support any efforts for adoption.
Is it something that you work on actively, though?
Yeah, absolutely.
As a policy?
Okay. Absolutely.
That's on your list of priorities.
Mm-hmm. Okay. We had a big hand in working on, I think it was House Bill 7, in the 128th General Assembly or 127th General Assembly, which had to do with adoption reform. We had a big hand in that. It's been, you know, a longstanding policy of ours to try and, for one thing, protect the rights of mothers who are giving their child up for adoption if they, you know, choose to keep it a closed adoption or something like that. We want to advocate for those women to make it easier for them to make that decision. And I would be remiss if I didn't mention our support of pregnancy centers all across the state. There's about 150 crisis pregnancy centers that operate statewide, and they do incredible work, phenomenal work, just supporting women who are making a decision to choose life. And they not only will help them, you know, throughout their pregnancy, but up to a year after the birth of their child, they'll provide things like material assistance, diapers, formula, clothing for their baby, all kinds of things. And, you know, to me, that's what being pro-life is. It's not just about, yes, we want you to keep your child. It's also, we'll help you do that, and here's how we can help.
So what's next, Stephanie, on the, assuming this passes, which it likely will, given the layout of the political layout in the legislature and in the governor's office, what's next on your list?
We are very thankful for the leadership of Senator Niehaus and also Speaker Batchelder and, you know, just the priority they've given to this issue, this General Assembly so far. We are really concentrating on getting a couple of our bills still passed before the summer recess.
Which couple are those?
House Bill 78, which is our post-viability abortion ban bill, which would ban late-term abortions. We know 77% of Ohioans, regardless of their party affiliation, support a late-term ban.
And how
on
many
abortions.
Late-term abortions are there?
There were 613 in 2009. That's the most recent year for which statistics are available.
And how many of those were for medical reasons?
Actually, none that we could find. We did a public records request with the Ohio Department of Health. The only way we have of knowing is on the form that the physician fills out when they perform the abortion. And there's a line that asks about the health condition of the mother. It was either listed as good or left blank for all 613 of those.
Kelly Copeland from NARAL Pro-Choice Ohio, what's next for you now?
Well, obviously, we're going to do our level best to stop the implementation of House Bill 78 because of the dangers it poses to women's health. But we're also working to be proactive. We're working to prevent unintended pregnancies and the transmission of sexually transmitted diseases. We'll be reintroducing our Prevention First Bill very soon. It would increase access to contraceptives and to comprehensive sex education. And you know, we believe that that is the better approach. We know that people who experience unintended pregnancies often also experience other things that we would like to prevent, like higher instances of low birth weight, higher instances of birth defects because they're not getting the prenatal care that they need perhaps as early as they could. So, you know, we're concerned with the full range of women's reproductive health care, and we'll be fighting for that from here on out.
It's Kelly Copeland. She's Executive Director of NARAL Pro-Choice Ohio. Kelly, thanks for joining us today.
My pleasure. Thank you for having us.
And also Stephanie Kreider. She is a Director of Legislative Affairs for Ohio Right to Life. Stephanie, thanks for being with us today.
Thank you, Anne. It was a pleasure.
This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
There are many ways to get the latest local news. Follow WOSU News on Twitter or find WOSU on Facebook. Get headlines delivered to your email by subscribing to our daily news loop e-newsletter at wosu.org/email.
This is 89.7 NPR News. In 20 minutes, beginning at 11 o'clock, hour two of All Sides begins with a discussion of Humphrey Bogart, classic movie star. Join us for that beginning at 11 on 89.7 NPR News. And you can listen to our station anytime, anywhere by streaming on the web. Just visit WOSU.org and click on Listen Live on the left-hand side of the page. Listen to local and national news programming online anytime at WOSU.org. And it's 81 degrees in downtown Columbus. We do have a chance of afternoon showers and thunderstorms today popping up at times, otherwise partly sunny and a high near 90. There's a chance of showers and thunderstorms for tonight, cloudy skies and a low of 66 degrees. Also a chance of showers and thunderstorms for Friday, and then partly sunny, a high of 85. Clouds for Friday night, a low of 67 degrees. And partly sunny as we look ahead to Saturday with a chance of rain and a high of 87. Be sure to join us for all the day's news later today on All Things Considered. Join NPR's Robert Siegel, Michelle Norris, and Melissa Block, along with 89.7's Marilyn Smith, later today beginning at 4. And All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
Welcome back to All Sides with Ann Fisher. Former Ohio Secretary of State and one-time Republican gubernatorial candidate, and also state treasurer for that matter, Ken Blackwell, believes the United States is at an unprecedented crossroads facing critical economic, social, and national security threats that require action. Ken Blackwell believes the greatest wisdom and guidance can be found within the framework of the Constitution and by following the principles of constitutional conservatism. Ken is former mayor of Cincinnati, former Ohio Secretary of State, as I mentioned before, former Ohio Treasurer. He served as Undersecretary in the Department of Housing and Urban Development and also Ambassador to the United Nations Human Rights Commission. His last bid for public office was in 2006 when he lost to Democrat Ted Strickland in the race for governor. Ken is with us today to talk about his new book, Resurgent: How Constitutional Conservatism Can Save America. Ken, welcome to the program.
And it's good to be with you.
Every time I talk to you, the list gets longer and longer. It takes longer and longer to introduce you. Before we get to the book, I wanted to talk politics for just a bit. You've said that you'll announce sometime around July 4th whether you will seek the Republican nomination for the U.S. Senate to run against Democrat incumbent Sherrod Brown in 2012. Why are you considering this race now?
Well, you know what? I really wasn't several months ago, but several polls, independent polls, were taken, and it showed that I was the leading Republican candidate among Republican and conservative voters to step up to the plate to challenge Sherrod Brown. I was basically satisfied running an organization called Pass the Balanced Budget. Those who are interested can go to passthebba.com and find out more about that program. It's addressing one of the leading crises facing the nation, and that is our national debt. I'm on the board of directors of the NRA and the Club for Growth, two highly engaged organizations. So I've had a full plate of activity crisscrossing the country and dealing with a whole range of issues. But I looked at the polls, and I started to talk to friends, and I listened to people from around the state who were encouraging me to consider it. And so I said, look, I've put over four decades into political office in Ohio as a mayor of Cincinnati and holding the offices that you just ticked off. And I've been on the national, you know, the national scene as an undersecretary at the U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development, dealing with a whole host of domestic issues with Jack Kemp. And then I served three years as the U.S. ambassador to the United Nations Human Rights Commission, a couple of years under Bush 41 and 1 year under Clinton. So I've had the on-the-ground experience, and I thought, let's take a look at it. So that's all I'm doing. Taking a look at it, talking with my family, friends, and supporters across the state and across the country. And if I conclude that, you know, I'm best suited to take on Sherrod Brown and defeat him, then I will do that.
The National Journal said that establishment Republicans in Ohio are bullish, that was their word, on the chances of Ohio Treasurer Josh Mandel. He has filed a statement of candidacy, but as you pointed out, he did trail you by about 16 percentage points in a Quinnipiac poll in May. But you can't, I mean, what's your take on the establishment Republicans' bullishness?
That's a pretty overly generalized statement. I mean, the chairman of the party has called me and said, look, the party has no favorites. I mean, the last time the so-called amorphous establishment took me on in 2006. I beat their candidate by 12 points. So I have no doubt that if they want to get behind a candidate as opposed to letting the primary voters decide, then I can take them on once again. This time around, I think I'll have a candidacy that is fueled by more and more folks who are dissatisfied with so-called amorphous establishment institutions that have maintained the status quo and not ushered in real change.
You know, running obviously for U.S. Senate is different than running for governor, and you would be running against a very different candidate. But would you run the same? Would you change? And I expect you to share your strategy, right?
I'm the same person. I have the same agenda as is reflected in my book and my first book. My last year, Ken Kukowski and I wrote a national bestseller. It was entitled The Blueprint, Obama's Plan to Build an Imperial Presidency. And look, this is a conservative antidote to that paragraph. And so we lay out a plan, and it's consistent from where I've always been. I'm a big champion of economic growth and free markets. I'm a strong supporter and leader in the movement for the Second Amendment rights in this country. And I lay that out. I'm going to be the same person this time around. Look, if you look at the agenda that got kicked out of the last election in 2010 and the agenda that got ushered in 2010, it was my agenda of lower taxes and cutting back the bureaucracy of the central government in Ohio, leveraging our assets expanding choice and empowering families and in expanding school choice. I think that this is something that the present governor has embraced, and I also think that he is on the right track in terms of reforming collective bargaining. We'll have a chance this fall to find out if the voters think so.
If just say you were elected in 2012, who among the current GOP hopefuls for the executive office would you look forward to working with?
We lay out in Resurgent a sort of grid by which I will be judging a whole range of candidates. So I don't have a candidate right now who I am the big champion for. That's what primaries are for. I want to see how they run that political race and see where they line up against those things that I think are important. Look, we have a country that's very rapidly becoming a culture where earning money doesn't entitle you to it, but wanting money does. I mean, that's the creed of redistributionists. We have a national debt crisis that is more the result of federal government and government in general's gluttony than it is about advancing individual liberty and economic freedom. Our national debt problem is a moral problem because of the intergenerational theft that we're participating in. It is a economic problem because of the anemic economic growth that government spending as a percentage of GDP is at about 42%. That is right on the track of not only the return of the welfare state, but is positioning us as a sort of European-style socialist state. And that is a problem. And it is a national security problem, that this debt, our national debt of ours, in that right now 47% of our national debt is held by foreign interests, and the majority of that is being held by the Chinese. You know, we have to pass a balanced budget amendment. We have to have supermajority requirements for raising spending and beyond 18% of GDP, federal government spending beyond 18% of GDP, and we have to have supermajorities to prevent the knee-jerk reaction to raising taxes. This is something that I've been for in 2006. I was for in 2000. And I'll be for in 2012.
You're listening to former Ohio Secretary of State Ken Blackwell. He is talking about some of the themes in his new book that he co-wrote with Ken Klukowski. The name of the book is Resurgent: How Constitutional Conservatism Can Save America. If you have a question or comment for Ken, we have a few minutes. Give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. You say in the book that there are three fault lines that could split the Republican Party. One is the Tea Party, of course. What are the other two?
Well, the essential issue is, and we use 1912 as an example, and Roosevelt with the Bull Moose Party, and so we're essentially saying that if we have a situation where social conservatives, national security conservatives, and economic conservatives don't see their common objective of returning us back to constitutional conservatism and limited government, then we're all either going to hang together or we're going to hang separately. And so that's the division that I'm most concerned myself with, is that we will find that some people say, well, let's call a truce on the social issues. Well, that's foolish on its face. There hasn't been a welfare state, a totalitarian government, an authoritarian government that hasn't attacked or weakened dramatically two intermediary institutions essential to American freedom, the family and the church. And if you try to scrub God and faith out of the public square, if you in fact reduce the role of the family, or you don't attend to those things that are breaking up the family, weakening the family, what you do is you create a vacuum. What fills that vacuum? Expanded government. And as I said before, one of the problems, one of the challenges, is that we're rapidly becoming a culture where earning money doesn't entitle you to it. Wanting money does.
But the culture changes, and the Constitution was written to be a quote-unquote living document.
No, it wasn't.
Well,
it was an enduring truth.
Otherwise, they wouldn't have left it open to interpretation.
Right. Mm-hmm. This living document theme is the theme of judicial activists who believe that they, in fact, can craft an America based on what they see as their vision of America from the bench. The original intent and the mm-hmm. structure of the Constitution allows for the people, we the people, to change the Constitution by a very deliberate process. And that is what's at stake here. Whether or not the people will be the master of the government, or whether the judicial bench and the central government will be the masters of the people. That is a clear difference in worldview.
We have an email from Brad. He says, we need to rein in government spending, and we need to start with entitlements. Why are some Republicans so reluctant to support Paul Ryan's budget? As a real conservative, what would you say to them?
Well, I would say that the only way that you're going to be able to save Social Security, the only way that you're going to be able to save Medicare and Medicaid, is by reforming them. If, in fact, you do nothing, you are guaranteeing their elimination, their destruction. And so Ryan has laid out a process for reforming them. And I think what has happened is that many Republicans have been scared to talk about reform, because reform has been defined by the Democrats and the left as being against the program and dedicated, that those of us who are talking about reform are dedicated to destroying the program. And that's ridiculous on its face.
You talk about a permanent solution to the challenges that face the United States. And I guess, you can look permanent up in the dictionary and it'll say something. But what do you mean by permanent solution? Because things change. I was wondering, how are you couching that?
Well, there are certain things that don't change. And let's think about that. The Declaration of Independence frames as what I consider to be the frame of the Constitution. And the second paragraph of the Declaration is, we hold these truths to be self-evident, which my dad used to say, it's a very polite way of saying any knucklehead should be able to get this. These are absolute truths. And that is that we're all created equal. We're not all equal in size, weight, income, but we all are equal in human dignity, and we're all equal to accountability and accountability to our Creator. It says we are endowed by our Creator with certain inalienable rights, which means that our human rights are not grants from government. They're gifts from God. And when you begin to believe that your human rights, all of your rights come from government, you begin to replace government with God. And that is a fundamental mistake. And so what I am saying is what is permanent is the enduring understanding that America is a country where the people are the masters of the government, not the other way around. And if we start from there, we begin to approach what I consider to be four wrong-headed ideas head-on. First, that the government can manage our economy better than markets and individual decisions. Two, that federal bureaucrats or government bureaucrats and professionals can make better decisions about our families than you and I can. The third is that the work ethic is old-fashioned and outdated. What has made us great has been that we are an industrious people. We are hardworking people, and we must get back to that basic understanding and establish and reinforce the work ethic. But the last one is the emergence of moral relativism, that we have no absolutes, that there are no endearing principles. There is no basis to this notion of original intent of the Constitution. And at the end of the day, this book is to inspire us around the principles that have defined us as a country and inspired us as a people. I am the first to tell you that we are an exceptional nation, but we are not exempt from moral limits or debt limits or the like. You know, we must, in fact, understand that we are at one of those periods in our 200 and almost 35 year history as a country, that how we handle it will define us, just as it did around the Civil War, World War II, the Civil Rights Movement, our response after 9/11, now this economic downturn, and how we come out of it will define us as a country. We lay out a roadmap.
Ken Blackwell
in the book.
Former Ohio Secretary of State, author and co-author of Resurgent, How Constitutional Conservatism Can Save America. I hope if and when you decide to run for the U.S. Senate, you'll join us again.
I will. That's a promise.
Thanks for joining us today, Ken. That's all the time we have. Thanks for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.